to me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Today is going to be one of those programs that we're going to remember for a while. We're going to start with the latest on health and healing and why staying up at night, being a night owl, is not a good idea. I'll explain why. Study from Northwestern University. But then I'm going to share some extraordinarily deep insights from a woman, a homemaker, who trusted the doctor, had her child given all the vaccines, was given assurances they were safe and effective, but they weren't. So she's written a little lyrical, it's not completely lyrical, statement about her experience. And I'm using this because this represents what I have personally discovered are the experiences of many, many people, many parents. And we have millions of parents who've been told it wasn't the vaccine. It was just a hypersensitive reaction. But it is the vaccine. We've been indoctrinated into accepting a lie. We're going to hear her. I think you'll find it very moving and extraordinarily important. Then we're going to have part three of an in-depth five-part discussion with two professors. Both are very progressive, and both are very controversial. And we can agree or disagree on any particular point they're making, but they swim in the deep waters intellectually. And I'm playing this because we need to have someone who can take a look at what we do every day, accept every day, hear every day, and put it into proper context, that we have been misled by academia and the professors and teachers and the curriculum. And that, unfortunately, then hinders students who want to learn and should learn, but are not, about life and the planet and the real world, that they're going to go from this embryo and cocoon of a protected university environment into the real world. So these people are giving us an idea of bringing that world view into the classroom. Very important. Then I'm going to have a guest on. I'll mention his name only at the beginning of that interview. He's a whistleblower. He has never been on radio before. You've never heard of him. But he has decided on ethics to come forward and share his statements on the record. He will not be anonymous. Why is this important? Because the show trial, it was just a farce of the softball questions asked of Mark Zuckerberg and only giving each person 5 minutes. And Zuckerberg clearly had been coached because he took nearly the 5 minutes to answer, talking in platitudes about the mission of Facebook and its reach and its philosophy, but not addressing the real questions, not giving us answers. You betrayed your listeners. You sold their data. You used others to use their data. And that's a violation. Oh, but not of the contract. So we're going after and exposing that part of the new movement to hold the big three, Google, Facebook, and Wikipedia, accountable. And we're going to show you their sins and omissions. Now, Richard Gale earlier in the week gave you a brief overview. Now we get into the nitty-gritty, and tomorrow, an original, in-depth, investigative report that's taken over a year, information I can promise you are not aware of, no matter how sophisticated you are, no matter how much you use the Internet, we're bringing you all new information to show you the dark side of the social media platforms. That's our program. Let's begin. The night owl people who stay up late and have trouble dragging themselves out of bed in the morning have a higher risk of dying sooner than people who have natural sleep preferences and get a full night's sleep at regular hours. That's according to the latest study from Northwestern Medicine and University of Surrey in the United Kingdom. The study examined 50,000 people and found that you're more likely to die over a 6.5-year period at a much higher level if you like staying up late at night. Quote, night owls trying to live in a morning lark world may have health consequences for their bodies. And then it goes on to talk about how serious those are. This was published in Chronobiology International, peer-reviewed journal. So they found that 10% higher risk of death, that's a big percentage, 10%, staying up late at night. So try to get to bed earlier. Now, occasionally you're going to be out partying or traveling or some reason to be out, staying up late. That won't cause any permanent damage. But if you're doing it on a regular basis, you're going to die sooner. We all should be aware that surface areas is where we pick up most of the bacteria or microorganisms that can cause us problems. I just posted on my personal Facebook page, and I post about 40 articles a day there. And I try to select the articles that would impact people all over the world, because people right now are listening all over the world. For example, when you use in any public restroom one of those air blowers, it shows you how much feces is on the actual air blower, because people who didn't thoroughly wash their hands touch it, and then it gets on your hands, and how then it blows that dried feces all up into your face and mouth and nostrils. And it could be from thousands of people. So we're always surrounded by bacteria. Now, any of us who have worked with food and have had food handler's license and food supervisory license know you have to be very conscientious in a kitchen. But most people are not conscious in their own kitchen. Kids running in and out, opening the refrigerator, touching everything, and they're not washing their hands. Your surface areas, you may put down a piece of meat, and they're not realizing later you put down some lettuce to cut it up. It's contaminated. So from the University of Lisbon, which is in Portugal, wonderful country, by the way, one of the few countries I would recommend for people who want to retire to, that have a low cost of living, a terrific group of people, low crime rate, and high quality aesthetics. And just if you're around the coast, it's just magnificently beautiful. Anyhow, from the University of Lisbon, they found that the risk of food poisoning from contaminated food surfaces can be reduced by using oregano oil to help kill bacteria. Oregano oil is an important culinary and medicinal herb. It's been used in medicine and cooking for thousands of years with a number of health benefits. And it's a species of what is called Origanum, belonging to the mint family. And it's extremely important in Turkish, Greek, and Portuguese, Spanish, Latin American, and Italian cuisine. And it's a must-have ingredient in tomato sauce, and it pairs well with capers and olives. Well, it is one of the top five spices in the world, with one of the highest ORAC, O-R-A-C, which stands for oxygen, radical, absorbance, capacity. And that has a high score, meaning it will more effectively neutralize free radicals. And it's also a very powerful antimicrobial. And oregano has shown antimicrobial activity in a number of studies. In fact, in one study, the oregano were effective against 41 strains of food pathogens, Listeria, which is extremely deadly. So you simply take a little bit of oregano oil, you dilute that in water and put it in one of those little spritzers, and spray your countertop and wipe it down. And by the way, I always recommend wild oregano oil, about 20 drops, diluted in a liquid with ginger, lemon, for bathing the throat with some Manuka honey also, for people who are having sore throat or congestion in the lungs, then swallowing it down. All the way in and clear down the intestines, it is killing harmful bacteria. Also from Massachusetts General Hospital, in Khyber Medical University in Pakistan, a study can show how chronic early life stress raises post-traumatic stress disorder vulnerability. This was a collaboration between universities at Massachusetts General Hospital and the University in Pakistan. And they've discovered a chronic stress experienced early in life increases your vulnerability. So you might have gotten over that early life trauma, but it's still registered in your brain. And according to this article on translational psychiatry, when you then become an adult and you experience any form of stress, then the body kicks in, remembers the old stress, and then you end up having an outbreak of post-traumatic stress disorder. What is the best way of remedying this? My experience with post-traumatic stress disorder is regressive hypnosis. I have found no therapy to equal that for actually overcoming it completely. Now, having pets that bond with you is also a very good way of dealing with it. Now, digital addiction is increasing loneliness, anxiety, and depression. This is a study at San Francisco State University. What am I talking about? I'm talking about smartphones, which are an integral part of most people's lives, allowing us to stay connected and in the know at all times. But the downside of that convenience is that many of us are also addicted to the constant pings and chimes and vibrations and other alerts from our devices. And most people are unable to ignore new emails or texts or images. This study published in Neuroregulation, and a San Francisco State University professor of health education went on to take a look at this, and he says, quote, "The behavioral addiction of smartphone use begins forming neurological connections in the brain in ways similar to how opiate addiction is experienced by people taking OxyContin and for pain relief. It happens gradually. On top of that, addiction to social media technology may actually have a negative effect on social connection." And this one review that they did, they showed that students who use their phone most reported higher levels of feeling isolated and lonely and depressed and anxious. They believe the loneliness is partly a consequence of replacing face-to-face interactions with a form of communication where body language and other signals cannot be interpreted. After all, when you're communicating over the internet, you're not looking at that person. You're not looking at their body language. You're not seeing the intonations in their voice. You lose that. When you're right in front of someone, you are. And this constant activity of always looking at your cell phone and always looking at the internet and watching other media and eating and attending class all in front of a computer, this constant activity allows little time for bodies and minds to relax and regenerate. And so break free of that and put yourself on a limited schedule. After all, the more eyeballs, more clicks, more money for the servers. So they're doing everything they can to get you completely addicted to believing that your whole world centers upon the input that your Facebook or Google gives you. From Pennsylvania State University comes a study about DHA. That's an essential fatty acid. But when you have DHA in combination with a good quality plant-based diet where you're caloric restricted, it lowers your obesity-related breast cancer. And that's a good study. So plant-based diet, DHA, and low calories, and you're going to have less likelihood of breast cancer. Also, from Catholic University in Rome, higher selenium levels equal improved survival in decades-long study of older individuals. Now, this article appeared in the current issue of the Journal of Nutrition, Health, and Aging, and it reveals a lower risk of death over a 10-year period among older men and women who had higher levels of the mineral selenium. And selenium is great. It reduces oxidative stress, helps prevent cancer. You don't eat a lot. 200 micrograms a day. Onions, garlic, they're good sources of selenium. Or just take a multiple vitamin that gives you your selenium each day. It also reduces our risk of interleukin-6 and C-reactive protein, which are markers of inflammation and also contribute to heart disease. Also, when you're deficient, when you don't have enough vitamin D, you're more likely to have painful digestive health. This is the University of Sheffield in the United Kingdom. That means irritable bowel syndrome, colitis, all these other itises in the intestine are exacerbated by low vitamin D. You don't need a lot of vitamin D. 1,000, 2,000 units a day can help reduce irritable bowel syndrome and other problems. It doesn't take a lot, but it's important. And that's the latest on Health and Healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, we're going directly into this mother talking on behalf of many mothers, millions, who the doctor, the nurse, the hospital, the pharmacist, nobody would take responsibility for a completely healthy child until they were vaccinated, and then something happened. And then, only then, did the mother realize she'd better start doing her homework. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I know everybody realizes that a man works better when he works out his own bag. Can you understand that? I can understand that. Candy bar, that girl and me, that's what you are. Oh, I can understand it. Jack and Jill going up the hill, smoking books and fairy tale.
As a mother of a vaccine injured child, the hardest comment to hear from people is when they say over and over again, "Don't listen to them. They're just a bunch of crazy mothers." I am a mother. I am the one who knows the rhythm of my child's heartbeat. I'm the one who gave life to this baby, no easy feat. I am that baby's first food, first sustenance in every sense of the word, emotionally, physically, spiritually, whether the first or the third. I have what it needs to survive and thrive. And now that they've grown a little, as a mother, I know when they need to eat or poop or get a big hug. I know when they are hiding. I know if they are lying. I know who hit who first without even trying. I know how they like to sleep, one bundled up, one without covers, and one somewhere in between. I know all of their dreams. I know their fears, their hopes. I know their wins and their losses. I know which one loves to brush her teeth and flosses every day so she won't get a cavity. I know how he won't eat it unless it's exactly right, so I'll make three meals just to avoid a fight. I know how to keep them safe, how to read the emotion on their little face, how one needs a nap while the other needs some space. I know how to juggle their feelings and toys and somehow keep it together with all that noise. And most importantly, I know what happened to my little boy. I know he had his shots one day at 6 months, the DTaP rotavirus HIB, and then fell into a deep sleep as I lay him in his crib, a sleep that instantly made me uneasy. When he awoke, he just screamed. He screamed for weeks and arched his back, but the nurses said it wasn't because of the DTaP. They said he just needed to poop because he hadn't in a couple of days. And so I prayed. And when he did finally go, it was green and slimy, so acidic it burned, and my mind was turning. I thought the Rotavax was supposed to prevent just that, diarrhea. For months it stayed that way. It seemed like his tummy got worse with each passing day. Every time I held him, I could feel the volcano that had replaced his stomach. But the doctor just said it was because he liked hummus and veggies. And then the ear infections began over and over, singles and doubles. But he'd received the HIB, which was supposed to prevent this. Still, the infections continued until I relented and he was put under to have tubes put in his tiny ears. My happy boy was no more. He was fussy and hurting, always in tears. I had no place to turn. I trudged on and realized I had so much to learn. He developed food allergies, another vaccine side effect. To gluten and dairy, to soy and to citrus, to everything it seemed except for my kisses, which I smothered him in to try and help him feel better. And then around 12 months, my nightmares came true as I watched the fog roll in. It tried to take my boy, too. I could see it in his face. He stopped smiling. He stopped waving. He stopped taking up space. He would stand by the window and not respond to his name. I knew then and there what was happening and began my crusade to bring my boy back, to fix my mistake. So imagine what happens when a mother realizes her child's injuries because of her. And a decision she made without researching to see if it was really as safe as they say, it drives you to the brink. And then you come back. And you think, what can I do? How can I fix this? I buried my pain. It wasn't important. Our lives have been changed. It's time to move forward. Then the research began. Studies published, books read. I reached out to doctors who scoffed and shook heads. But the new doctors and parents who embraced us with degrees, knowledge, and motives we can trust, who knew what we'd been dealing with, what was our truth. We weren't making this up. And there are things you can do to help your child recover from you. So we focused on that, what we knew. The biggest thing was, as always, the food. We changed our whole diet and lifestyle too. I wanted to heal him, not just get him through. So more research, more books, supplements, 2 probiotics and enzymes as he turned 2. He was getting better, but still verbally delayed. And I will never forget that beautiful day when I knew this regimen was working because he looked at me and sang. His ABCs, out of the blue. He had never uttered a part of that song before. My heart skipped a beat as my jaw hit the floor. I felt hope that day and gratitude in so many ways for the amazing doctors and authors and friends who'd kept us sane. The chiropractor, the diet, boosting his immune system, eliminating the toxins that can constantly surround him. It was all helping. Pieces of the puzzle were coming together. The fog that rolled in lifted and we saw better weather. Turns out there's a gene, a genetic mutation, that actually impairs your body's methylation. So kids who have this MTHFR or another variant, there's at least 50 so far, have a hard time removing the toxics within the vaccines. And there are plenty. We can go down the list, but there's almost too many. Fetal calf serum is a personal fave. Monkey kidney cells and aluminum phosphate. Now, aluminum is dangerous, or so says the FDA. No more than 25 micrograms a day. But in a shot, it's okay, which is good since a single vaccine can contain up to 800 micrograms. Insane. And what heavy metal have they started to say causes Alzheimer's? I'll give you a hint. It starts with an A. Then there's the formaldehyde, the egg protein, and of course aborted fetal cells. They do try to filter the dead baby stuff out, which is why it's listed as an excipient, no doubt. But the study that found injected DNA can still become biologically active and mutate? I won't get into that here, but let's just say we have no freaking clue if that's even remotely safe. There aren't enough studies, period. But why? I mean, we're talking about our children. You think they'd at least try to make sure that the adjuvants, excipients, preservatives, and of course the virus, dead or alive, will not harm as they stand there and inject it into his arm. Where's the 50-year longitudinal study of vax versus unvax? Why hasn't that happened? If the science is settled, then where is the data? Unavoidably unsafe. Or at least that's what our Supreme Court states, which makes sense when you look at the loads of vaccine injury cases and the amount of money that's been paid to keep families complacent. It's an astounding amount of money each year. A couple $100 million, just so we're clear, and that's just the families that made it to court. So many others don't know they can report it. Doctors say the reactions are normal. Chalk it up to coincidence and never record it. Parents get lost in the shuffle, don't know who to believe, and then begin the journey of trying to grieve for their kid who regressed. They start digging through the mess and trying to find a lawyer with time and energy spent whilst dealing with a sick kid or one that's now dead. That's why the CDC itself estimates only 1 to 10% of problems end up in their database. Go look up the numbers. The website's called VAERS. Do the math and then tell me reactions are rare. Now, there is another topic at hand, and this is the stuff that I really can't stand. People that call us crazy, they don't stop there. Mothers don't know how to read a study. They should shut up and go worry about their hair. Us crazy mothers are from all walks of life, including medical professionals. We've endured ridicule and strife, families ripped apart, friends lost. Speaking out against big pharma comes at a high cost, and still we soldier on because we hope that one day this madness will end and our kids will be safe, safe from the now 50 injections the CDC mandates. I've scoured hundreds of studies at this point in time, and so far none of them have given me peace of mind. There isn't a safety study that takes all ingredients combined and injects it into a primate group of some kind whilst having a placebo control group and watching them for signs of neurological, physical, and developmental demise, and then follows them for years, since it can take a long time for the damage to appear and for people to realize that the autoimmune disorders, allergies, and diseases of the mind all come back to this one thing we refer to as causal ties. No study like that exists. The best the CDC can do is hand me a list of just some of the life-changing reactions that can occur and tell me not to worry, don't look any further. Definitely don't confer with the millions of parents who are fighting to be heard. I've come across this so many times. I can't ignore it anymore. I'm drawing the line. When trying to provide some proof of our experience. Hey, guys, wait. Wait, look what I just read. It's making me irate. No, little girl. You don't know how to read. Go back to where you came from and continue to breed. Don't question about your babies. Leave that to us. We know the science. In God's name, you trust. All of our crazy mother stories are different and yet the same, because every single one of them contain a feeling of dread. A vaccine, a reaction, and the realization you've just made your bed. Now you have to lie in it. But I'm not.
Women are now waking up, and they're asking questions before vaccination. And the more educated the woman, the more questions they're asking. And that's why a lot are going against mandatory vaccines. My hope is that there is an awakening across the country. We need a Me Too movement for vaccine-damaged children. The government is not responsible. Pharmaceutical companies don't have to be responsible. Your doctor, nurse, and pharmacist are not taking any of the blame. It's all left upon the woman, the husband. And it's that we supported that and tried to help them, because no one else is. From our environmental segment today from Common Dreams, something I told you about a long time ago, about 9 to 10 years ago. At that time, I talked about the tipping points, and I said the one tipping point that you should be very concerned about is the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream is what takes warm water from South America, the equator, and brings it up through and across the Atlantic. And so that's where Ireland and Scotland, Cork in Scotland, which Ireland is south of Ireland, they can actually grow pineapple there. It's so warm. And then it brings cool water back down from Iceland, Greenland. Well, according to the latest study just out today, quote, concerns of a catastrophic collapse grow as the Gulf Stream weaker than it's been in 1,600 years. Quote, in response, experts are calling for further study, declaring that questions raised by a pair of reports are among the most pressing questions in climate change. And new research published yesterday in the journal Nature raises alarm about how global warming is impacting the Atlantic Ocean Gulf Stream system and how weakening ocean currents could influence extreme weather in Western Europe and sea level rise along North America's east coast. So it's here. We warned you. Now, when this happens, and it will, probably in the next 12 to 24 months, you're going to see a radical change in the temperatures. And that is not good. Also, the second big thing we warned you about was the melting ice in the Arctic and the loss of glaciers. The newest report is, in another 5 years, we won't have any glaciers in the United States. And all that water is going into the ocean. And that's on mountains, that's eliminating snowpack, which feeds, when it melts over a period of months, it feeds the streams and creeks and estuaries and rivers. It's drying up. So buckle up. You're in for a bumpy ride. I'm going to be doing a series of shows of what to do. Because at this point, even though there is a concerted effort around the world in different countries to deal with some aspect of climate change, nothing's being done in America. So you're on your own. You'll stay on your own. And you were on your own in Houston when 21 trillion gallons of water fell in the city over a seven-day period, the most in American history. You're on your own in California when all those houses burned. Yeah, there were firefighters. There's nothing to prevent it, nothing to compensate all the people. Insurance companies are offering pennies on the dollar, and people are going broke. So what can you as individuals do? I'll be having a series on this very topic over the next several weeks. Now we're going to part three of a clip, and following that will be our special guest. And I'll probably only do 10 minutes of this clip, so we have time for the guest. This is two professors, Peglia and Jordanson.
Techniques that I would use against a man who was employing those tactics are forbidden to me. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Like, it seems to me that it isn't men that have to stand up and say enough of this, even though that is what they should do. It seems to me that it's sane women who have to stand up against their crazy sisters and say, look, enough of that, enough man-hating, enough pathology, enough bringing disgrace on us as a gender. But the problem there, and then I'll stop my little tirade, is that most of the women I know who are sane are busy doing sane things, right? They're off, they have their career, they have their family, they're quite occupied, and they don't seem to have the time or maybe even the interest to go after their crazy harpy sisters. And so I don't see any regulating force for that terrible femininity. And it seems to me to be invading the culture and undermining the masculine power of the culture in a way that's, I think, fatal. I really do believe that.
I too believe that this is symptomatic of the decline of Western culture, and it will just go down flat. I don't think people realize that, you know, the masculinity still exists, okay, in the world as a code among jihadists, okay, and
yes.
And when you have passionate masculinity, okay, circling the borders like the Huns and the Vandals during the Roman Empire, that's what I see. I see this culture rotting from within, okay, and disemboweling itself, literally. Now, I have an overview of why we're having these problems, right? And it comes from the fact that I'm the product of an immigrant family. All four of my grandparents and my mother were born in Italy. So I remember from my earliest years in this factory town in upstate New York, where my relatives came to work in the shoe factory, I can remember still, okay, the life of the agrarian era, okay, which was for most of human history, okay, the agrarian era, where there was the world of men and the world of women. And the sexes had very little to do with each other. Each had power and status in its own realm, right? And they laughed at each other in essence,
mm-hmm,
okay?
Yeah.
The women had enormous power. In fact, the old women ruled, not the young, beautiful woman like today, okay? But the older you were, the more you had control over everyone, including the mating and marriage. There were no doctors, so the old women were like midwives and knew all the ins and outs of this inherited knowledge about pregnancy and all these other things, right? I can remember this and the joy that women had with each other all day long, okay, cooking with each other, you know, companions to each other, talking, conversing. My mother remembered as a small child in Italy, when it was time to do the laundry, they would take the laundry up the up the hill to the fountain, Il Sorgo, okay, and do it by hand. They would sing, they would picnic, and so on, all right? And we get a glimpse of that in the Odyssey, when Odysseus is thrown up naked on the shores of Phaeacia, all right? And he hears the sound of women, young women laughing and singing, and it's Nausicaa, the princess, bringing the women to do the laundry. Okay, it's exactly the same thing, okay? So there was each gender had its own hierarchy, its own values, its own way of talking, and the sexes rarely intersected. Like, I can remember in childhood, on a holiday, typical, it could be a Christmas, it could be a Thanksgiving, whatever, the women would be cooking all day long, everyone would sit down to eat, okay, and then after that, okay, the women would retire en masse to the kitchen, and the men would go, I would look at through the window and see all the men would be all outside, usually gather around the car, okay, at a time when cars didn't work as well as they do today, with the hood up, okay? And the men would be standing with their hands on their hips like that, everyone staring at the engine. Okay, I went, that's how I learned, okay? Men were refreshing themselves by studying something technical and mechanical after being with the women, okay, you know, for during the dinner, okay, and so on. So all of these problems of today are the direct consequence of women's emancipation and freedom from housework, thanks to capitalism, okay, which made it possible for women to have jobs outside the home for the very first time in the 19th century, no longer to be dependent on husband or father or brother, right? And so this great thing that's happened to us, that allowing us to be totally self-supporting, independent agents, has produced all this animosity between men and women, because the women feel unhappy. Women today, wherever I go, whether it's Italy or Brazil or England or America, okay, or Toronto, okay, the upper middle class professional women are unhappy, miserable. They want, and they don't know why they're unhappy. They want to blame it on men. Okay, men must change. Men must become more like women. No, that is the wrong way to go, okay? It's when men are men, okay, and understand themselves as men, are secure as men, then you're going to be happier.
But there's nothing more dangerous than a weak man.
Yeah, absolutely, okay? And especially all these quizzlings, okay, spouting feminist rhetoric I hear that, okay? I mean, it makes me sick. But here's the point. Men and women have never worked side by side, ever. Maybe on the farms, okay, when you were like, maybe one person's in the potato field, the other one's over here in the doing tomatoes or whatever, okay? You had families working side by side, exhausted with each other, no time to have any clash of this. It was a collaborative effort on farms and so on. Never in all of human history have men and women been working side by side. And women are now the pressure about Silicon Valley. They're also sexist. Oh, they don't allow women in and so on. Men are being men in Silicon Valley, all right, and so on. And the
especially
women,
the engineers.
And the women are demanding that, oh, this is terrible, you're being sexist. Maybe the sexes, okay, have their own particular form of rhetoric, their own particular form of, you know, of identity, okay? Maybe, okay, we need to re-examine, okay, this business about, you know, maybe we have to perhaps accept some degree of tension and conflict between the sexes, okay, in a work environment. I don't mean harassment. I'm talking about women feeling disrespected. How somehow their opinions when they express them, okay, are not taken seriously, or even Hillary Clinton is complaining. Oh, when a woman writes something online, she's attacked immediately, and so on. Well, everyone's attacked online. What are you talking about? The world is tough. The world is competitive. Okay, identity is honed, okay, by conflict. The idea that there should be no conflict, that we have to be in this bath, okay, of approbation.
Yes.
Devouring infantile.
Mother. That's right. It's absolutely infantile. I mean, okay. So a couple of things there. Well, the first thing is that the agreeableness trait that divides men and women most, there's three things that divide women and men most particularly from the psychometric perspective. One is that women are more agreeable than men. And so that seems to be the primary maternal dimension as far as I can tell. It's associated with a desire to avoid conflict, but it's associated with interpersonal closeness, compassion, politeness. Women are reliably higher than men, especially in the Scandinavian countries and in the countries where egalitarianism has progressed the farthest. So that's where the difference is maximized, which is one of the things James Damore pointed out quite correctly in his infamous Google memo. Okay, women are higher in negative emotion, so that's anxiety and emotional pain. That difference is approximately the same size. And again, that maximizes in egalitarian societies, which is extremely interesting. And then the biggest difference is the difference in interest between people and things. And so women are more interested in people and men are more interested in things, which goes along quite nicely with your car anecdote. But the thing about men interacting with men, again, is that it isn't that they respect each other's viewpoints. That's not exactly right. What happens with a man, and I know a lot of men that I would regard as remarkably tough people for one reason or another, and everything you do with them is a form of combat. Like, if you want your viewpoint taken seriously, often you have to yell them down, and like, they're not going to stop talking unless you start talking over them, you know. And it's not like men are automatically giving respect to other men, because that just doesn't happen. It's that the combat is there and it's expected. And one of the problems, and so this is part of the reason why I think men are bailing out of so much of academia and maybe the academic world in general, and maybe the world in general, is that men actually don't have any idea how to compete with women. Because the problem is that if you unleash yourself completely, then you're an absolute bully. And there's no doubt about that, because if men unleash themselves on other men, that can be pretty goddamn brutal, especially for the men that are really tough. And this, so that just doesn't happen with women ever. But so you can't unleash yourself completely. If you win, you're a bully. If you lose, well, you're just bloody pathetic. So how the hell are you supposed to play a game like that? Mm-hmm. You know, so in, I've worked with lots of women in law firms in Canada, for example, and high-achieving women, like really remarkable people, I would say. And they're often nonplussed, I would say, by the attitude of the men in the law firm, because they would like to see everyone pulling together because they're all part of the same team. Whereas the men are like at each other's throats in a cooperative way, because they want the law firm to succeed, but they want to be the person who's at the top of the success hierarchy, right? So, and that doesn't jive well with the more competitive or cooperative ethos that's part and parcel of agreeableness. And so we don't really have any idea how to integrate male and female dominance hierarchies. And
exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. This is why I love...
Okay, and We'll continue with this discussion tomorrow. Two really brilliant minds, Jordan Peterson and Camille Paglia. Now let's go to our guest who is standing by in Los Angeles, Rome Viharo. I believe, is that how you pronounce your name, Viharo?
Yes, sir. You did well first time, which is rare. Good job.
Thank you, Rome. He is the founding president of Native Smart, Inc., in Southern California. That's a young private company that has developed the first content private exchange platform and network for mobile phones. And during the past 12 years, Rome has been an independent editor with an official editor's account with Wikipedia, the online open source encyclopedia run by MediaWiki Foundation. And during his time working within the online quarters of Wikipedia's editorial activities, he has observed firsthand how certain groups and organizations and individuals outside of the Wikipedia organization have dominated its public space to promulgate personal agendas and biases. In response, he created the commentary blog, Wikipedia, We Have a Problem, and which identifies and exposes the chaos behind the scenes in Wikipedia's editorial activities. In the past, he has been sought out by Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, the British biologist who's appeared many times on this program, who proposed the theory of morphogenic fields, and Deepak Chopra to perform editorial cleanups on his Wicca biographies in opposition to skeptic and scientific atheist groups determined to denigrate anything associated with non-conventional medicine and the paranormal. His website is Wikipedia, wehaveaproblem.com. So it's nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on your program.
To start off, let me first inform the audience that you have been an avid supporter of Wikipedia in principle and its basic mission to provide a free access encyclopedia founded upon the consensus building of editors and the public. However, over the years, it would seem that Wikipedia, this is my personal opinion, has moved in directions far removed from its original mission. I'll give you an example. I did not put anything of myself up on Wikipedia, but one of my avowed enemies, Dr. Stephen Barrett, who himself has been completely discredited by court documents that he is not an expert in what he claims to be, but the American media has followed him and the pro-pharmaceutical lobby of skeptics and critics for decades. And you never have a chance to get a correction. So when he puts something up on Wikipedia about me, we then send a lawyer's letter showing every single statement up there is wrong. And we supply the actual documentation that it's all wrong and that he is a biased source. But according to Wikipedia, you're not allowed to use biased sources. And every single effort we have made over the years, we have not been allowed to make a single change on that site. So for me to admit today, speaking on behalf of myself and others in the field of health, everyone has been denigrated. Everyone has been abused in the Wikipedia, and none have had an opportunity to know who is doing the attacking, who is funding them, or what is their ideological base. And so I consider this one of the worst forms in the world. The world. And the fact that it started with a good notion, I see what it's morphed into. Now, fortunately, I have a large audience, and I am successful in all fields that I've engaged in. So they can't destroy me. They can only prevent people who don't know me from wanting to know me, wanting to listen to this radio program. So I bring that to you, and I'd like you to address that because I'm not the only one. There are many other people who have had the same experience as myself. The forum is yours. Please take us on that road of discovery.
Sure, sure. Just to start off, I mean, one, I certainly understand what it is that you're going through. For sure, you are not the only person who is going through that. My interest in Wikipedia originally is just in its consensus building mechanisms. So I'm a platform developer, so I am also developing a platform for online consensus building. So then there's a number of different problems here. One is the overall problem of just internet harassment and misinformation across the board. Every platform from Facebook to Twitter to Wikipedia or any media wiki is having that problem. The second problem is that there is a community. Sometimes I have to be very careful how I contextualize this community. This community on Wikipedia, many of them do identify themselves as skeptics or skeptic activists. They blog about editing Wikipedia on their blogs. They encourage other skeptics to participate. And then you have the more traditional Wikipedia community, which tend to have its own kind of institutional biases. And then on top of that, you have the core problem on Wikipedia, which is really just the platform software itself. And this, the platform software itself is really what enables, I would say, certain psychologies within any ideological group to kind of come in and really toxify the community and prevent people, certain individuals, from actually having a path of recourse on Wikipedia. And I myself proved this. I was originally contacted by Rupert Sheldrake a few years ago. At the time, I was a light Wikipedia editor. By the way, I don't want to misinform your audience. I created an account in 2006, but I edited very lazily. When I saw a mistake here and there, I would correct it, but I was not a very active Wikipedia editor. I am an active Wikipedia user as a researcher. And so Rupert just asked me for my advice. He said, hey, I'm having this problem. There's editors on my article, and other people are going in and trying to edit the article, and they feel like they're getting harassed away, and I really don't know how to solve this problem. And at the time, I really didn't either, but I was always fascinated by what are known as wiki wars. And wiki wars are essentially battles to control a narrative on Wikipedia. And I think probably the most infamous ones, you know, involve really intense global conflicts like Israel and Palestine and things like that, which is very intimidating for me. So when I went into Rupert Sheldrake's article and I saw what was happening, one, it seemed like a safe place for me to come to a deeper understanding of how consensus building works on Wikipedia. And I was so fascinated by the problem, I told Rupert I would go in and help, but I would take it on as my own project. He didn't have to pay me or anything. It was really out of my own interest and curiosity. And within a few days on Wikipedia, I not only was I harassed, but I was doxxed. I had my personal information and my identity released to the Wikipedia community. And shortly thereafter, I was banned indefinitely from the encyclopedia, or blocked indefinitely from editing. And then I had a harassment campaign put on me, which was immediately an article was written about me on Rational Wiki that was obviously designed just to embarrass someone and to really misrepresent my intentions and who I am in the world. So after that, I began to publish Wikipedia, We Have a Problem, and really just document this activity that originally, from my experience, happened when I went in to help build a consensus on Rupert Sheldrake's article, which I did, by the way. Then Deepak Chopra contacted me a few months after on Twitter, of all places, and he was asking for my advice on his Wikipedia problem. Now, originally, Deepak Chopra, and Gary, this is something, by the way, you can consider too, but originally Deepak Chopra wanted to just get his article deleted off of Wikipedia, which is something that you can do, right? A subject, if they believe that their article is being abused, they can petition the Wikimedia Foundation to have their article deleted. So that's why Deepak contacted me originally. It was just, hey, like, can I just get this deleted? And can you walk me through that process? Can you just kind of represent me getting this article deleted? I recommended, actually, that Deepak take a different approach. And the approach that I recommended Deepak taking was, hey, why don't we embrace Wikipedia's principles? I love, by the way, I love Wikipedia. I love the ideals of it. I love where they get things right. I really do. And I really want Wikipedia to work. And I encouraged Deepak to kind of go down that road, too. And I said, listen, let's go through the process. I'll be your representative. So Wikimedia will allow you, Gary as well as Deepak, will allow you to have a representative on the article. So we would basically petition the article and go by strictly by the book on Wikipedia's guidelines and policies. I myself did no editing on Deepak Chopra's article, so any changes to his article would have to come purely from consensus building, and other editors would have to make them, not me. So that's what I did with Deepak, and through that process, one, I was able to, with the community, actually correct the article. And this was done because I did have a lot of these, I guess, skeptic groups on Wikipedia. They were trying to, you know, harass me, and they were bringing me to different notice boards to sanction me or block me. But none of that worked because we were able to bring attention to the problem. And there are some really great Wikipedia editors on Wikipedia. So this is not to say that the entire community is this way. It's really just a small handful. So to make a long story short, I was, of course, after the article changed, I was almost the same thing happened. Members of the Wikipedia community who were harassing me discovered that it was really me, Rome Vaharo, who they knew as the Tumbleman from Sheldrake's article, and had me blocked. And then they had Deepak Chopra's article completely reverted from all the work that we did together, building it, making the article more neutral. And keep in mind, the support that I got when I did this for Deepak Chopra was from senior Wikipedia editors. Slim Virgin is a very senior, experienced Wikipedia editor, has a lot of clout in the community. Not only did she defend me on Wikipedia and some of these notice boards, but she was the one responsible for correcting the article. I had support from a number of admins that I was being, you know, harassed and just bullied and just normal, just kind of toxic behavior. So to make a long story short, what that case study shows is that a notable person, and Deepak Chopra is an incredibly famous person, is very notable in the world. A notable person has really no path of recourse on Wikipedia. And what happened is after they blocked me from editing, Deepak Chopra actually wound up having another representative on the article, who I know. And they eventually got Deepak Chopra's second representative blocked from editing on his page because he knew me, because he had a relationship with the person who was the publisher of Wikipedia, We Have a Problem. So this completely prevented Deepak Chopra from having a reasonable path of recourse that is allowed to him by the Wikimedia Foundation from going through. So okay. I have been...
Rome, I thank you very much for coming on, and Richard Gill will be talking to you about doing a full hour in the next week or two on this very topic.
All right. Thank you, Gary, for having me on your show.
Whistleblower, Rome Vaharo, V-I-H-A-R-O, my guest. This is just a continuation. Tomorrow, you won't want to miss an in-depth original investigative report on these individuals at Wikipedia, Google, and Facebook. Have a nice day, everyone.